You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. For years, Americans have taken advantage of cheap Chinese imports, but recent reports of tainted dog food, defective children's toys, and contaminated heparin have made it clear that cheap goods come at a steep price. Alexandra Harney, a Hong Kong-based journalist who also, by the way, is really hilarious, explores the Chinese manufacturing system in a new book, The China Price, The True Cost of Chinese Competitive Advantage. It's published by the Penguin Group, and I'm delighted that it brings Alexandra Harney to the show today. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. We were having a very good time laughing about you were formerly with the Financial Times.
That's right.
And you said you went freelance.
Yes.
And decided to, you wanted to be poor and live on $4 a day and explore
China. I call it
my
polenta days, because polenta is all I can afford. Very cheap polenta if you eat it on its own.
Well, let's talk about your book. So what is the China Price?
The China Price was a term that executives started to use around 2003 to describe these unbeatably low prices coming out of China. You know, one-fifth, a half of the cost of the same good made in America. But in my book, I talk about it more broadly as the cost that American workers have paid in terms of losing their jobs to China, in terms of the cost that Chinese workers have paid in terms of losing their arm into the industrial machine. And so it's a broader idea of what the China Price means to the rest of the world.
And as you just said before, I mean, consumers are actually, American consumers are paying dearly for the China Price. But what exactly do you mean by that?
I don't mean that they're paying. Obviously, we're benefiting. Mm-hmm. We save money. You know, by one calculation, we save about $500 per household per year buying cheap goods from China. But what I mean is in terms of the fact that we know less and less about where our goods are coming from. We buy, you know, so much, billions and billions from China every year, and yet I found in my research for my book that we don't really actually know exactly where and how those goods are made. Hmm. That Chinese factories do a pretty good job at covering up exactly the conditions in which things are made. I found a whole network of shadow factories where you know, it's a parallel network of factories where things are made.
Well, I want to get to that later on, because we've got a long time to talk
about
this.
Yeah, of course.
But is the American consumer responsible for perpetuating the China Price?
Well, the American consumer is not responsible, but I think we all have a stake in knowing more about where our goods are coming from. So we all expect lower prices. And what I talk about in the China Price is how those low prices affect people across the world and ultimately come back to affect us.
Mm-hmm. How exactly is China or Chinese businesses, how are they able to make all of these products for and then sell them to us for pennies, really? How's that possible?
Well,
because we can't seem to do it here, right?
Obviously, the number one factor in that is the difference in the wages. But mm-hmm. what's happened in China is that you've got every factory has about 1,000 competitors. It's just a huge amount of competition on the ground. Then we've got all the buyers that come from the West and know that they can always find a factory down the road who can make it for cheaper. Mm-hmm. And then China, in its effort to promote investment from abroad, has done a good job at neglecting to enforce its own laws. So that's part of it. If you don't enforce your own labor laws and your own environmental laws, that lowers the cost of doing business.
Those laws, were they the result of pressure from the West, pressure from the United States, or were those laws proactively put in by Chinese leadership?
The Chinese put in their own laws. They've had a labor law since 1995 in effect. They just introduced a new labor law. And actually, Chinese labor laws are tougher than American labor laws, which is surprising to a lot of people in the U.S.
Wait, talk more about that, because that's not the impression you'd get.
Yeah. China's labor law, which came into effect in 1995, like I said, imposes strict limits on the working hours, the hours you can spend on the assembly line or on the job anywhere. It has rules on overtime. Time and very strict rules about insurance payments. I mean, in America, by contrast, we have a much freer approach to our labor laws.
Wow. So do you think that the Chinese government just passed these laws just to look good to the West and to the U.S. and maybe Potemkin village type laws?
Right. Well, no, I don't think so. I think that the intention is there. China is still nominally a communist country. There is nominally still the concern for the worker. But the problem is enforcement. China has what some factory executives in China call beautiful laws. The laws are excellent on the books about labor and the environment, but the enforcement is lacking. They just don't. Mm-hmm. There are only, I think, about 22,000 labor inspectors in China and a workforce of more than 750 million people.
Yeah. It's a minimal workforce there.
Yeah.
I'm Jonathan Capehart here today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Alexandra Harney, the author of The China Price, The True Cost of Chinese Competitive Advantage. Now, tell us what you found when you investigated Chinese factories. And you mentioned this earlier about shadow factories and other types of factories.
Right. Well, the shadow factory phenomenon is something I uncovered while I was doing the research. A shadow factory is essentially a secret subcontractor. One of the factories that I describe in the book is producing for Walmart. And if you visit the factory as a Westerner, you would go and you'd see a very good looking factory. Looks like any other relatively good factory in China. But little did, in this case, the Walmart inspector know, around the corner, about 10 minutes drive away, was another factory, also subcontracting, basically, for that model factory. Hmm. And the other factory had much worse conditions, no fire extinguishers. The workers there, if someone asked them where they worked, they would tell them that they were unemployed. It's just, a totally different conditions. And you don't really know what happens inside that factory.
And so Walmart sends its own inspectors, and I guess other companies send their own inspectors. And so is it that they didn't want to discover these shadow factories? I mean, you discovered them.
Yes.
Was it difficult for you to find them?
It was very difficult to get access to them. Mm-hmm. Because there is a real incentive to cover them up. By one account, or by many people I spoke to, they said, these are the majority of factories in southern China have a shadow factory. In order to be able to make goods at such a cheap price, they have to cut corners somehow. Mm-hmm. And so I think I spoke to Walmart about it, and they told me that they were aware that some people had subcontractors and that they wished that people would bring them forward. I don't know what was going on in the mind of that inspector, but I think that the Chinese factories do a pretty good job of covering it up. And also, if you think about the fact that all these retailers and brands use thousands and thousands of factories, and they have to get through and inspect all of those for quality and then sometimes for working conditions, well, often for working conditions as well.
So the shadow factory network is basically an open secret. It's just a matter of being able to go from, what's it called, the five-star factory to finding that shadow factory 10 minutes away or however far away.
That's
now,
right.
Now, maybe in your answer you said this and I missed it, but were you actually able to go to a shadow factory and see the conditions and see the workers?
I was able to. The factory owner took me from the five-star factory to the shadow factory, but he wouldn't allow a Western woman onto the floor of the shadow factory because even he didn't want to go inside. He said, you eat chicken, but you don't want to see a chicken being killed.
Wow. and so you never...
I never got inside, but I mean, I spoke
to break through.
Yeah, I spoke to a lot of people. There's a whole network of people who inspect these Chinese factories for labor violations, and they know about these shadow factories. And I was inside another one earlier on while I was at the Financial Times, and it didn't look that different. It wasn't officially part of a factory. It was up on the fifth floor of an industrial building. You would never have known it was there unless you knew to look for it.
Mm-hmm. So how did you get access to the workers you ended up talking to and basing the book on? How did you find them?
Well, I found them through it all started actually back when in 2003, 2004, when I first got to Hong Kong. I went up to visit this one factory, a garment factory, and started talking to this worker. And she was sort of one of thousands of workers there on the line and hunched over her sewing machine. And I asked her about her life. And she said that, she made probably $100 a month. And most of it she sent home to her family in the countryside. And I said, well, don't you have a lot of money left over to, buy new clothes? And she said, no, she had enough money for soap and tissues. And I just thought, man, you have a really important role in the global economy. I'd love to get to know you better. And so I sought to meet more people like her through NGOs and other people I knew. And so I just started spending as much time as I could with these workers, taking them to work in the morning, meeting up with them at night.
And were they afraid to talk to you, to tell you their stories? And, I mean, I would suspect that there's a huge trust level that must that you must get to with workers for them to open up and share their stories.
Yeah, I mean, I think it helped that I spoke Chinese, so I was able to speak
that
to them
helps.
Directly. Yeah, that worked. And as my Chinese got better, a lot of these girls also became my Chinese teachers in a way, teaching me, you know, different terms. And so I think just spending time with them and finding the right group of workers and winning their trust was really key.
Now, so you spoke Chinese.
Yes.
But was it Chinese 101 or was it Chinese, high school Chinese, college Chinese? You weren't fluent.
No, I'm not. I'm not totally fluent, but it was definitely good enough to get all the information. And I mean, I speak enough to do all the research for my book in Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And when I didn't understand, I would record my conversations. I recorded all my conversations and then would bring it home to someone who could help me piece together the parts that I didn't get.
And when you talked to folks and you went to the factories and you talked to folks there, were you ever concerned about your own safety?
Yeah, I was always very careful. I kept the book a secret the whole time I was writing it. I didn't talk about it on the phone. I didn't talk about it to my friends unless I was in a public place. One time when I was up in rural China, I was interviewing the widow of a jewelry worker who had died from silicosis, a lung disease that he'd contracted on the assembly line. And I asked him, I visited with her and some other widows and wives of people who'd gotten sick. And then at 11:30 at night, that night, a police officer paid me a visit in my hotel room, wanted to see my identification, wanted to know why I was in rural China, what was there for me to see. And so I was able to get off without being detained, but I did leave the next morning first thing.
Wow. And so I guess the Chinese government, like Beijing, was not thrilled about you doing any of this. Were you followed? Did you have someone, talk about shadow factories, you have someone shadowing you wherever you went?
No, as a journalist, I did often have someone who would pick me up and take me to my interview and sit in on my interview. But I left journalism to do the book. I became a visiting fellow at the University of Hong Kong so that I could become an academic and not be a journalist, because journalists carry a certain kind of reputation, especially foreign journalists in China.
Reputation?
Well,
I want to know in case I go to China.
Definitely, if you have a journalist stamp in your passport, you know, the people are much more aware of what you're doing and why you're there. So there's a lot more concern. But I took a lot of precautions using payphones, as I said, keeping it a secret, using code to talk to my boyfriend, stuff like that.
How long did it take you to – you left journalism to do the book.
Yep.
And so how long were we talking?
Almost 2 years, more than a year and a half, between a year and a half, 2 years to do the whole thing full time.
Wow. And now you are
living
on, what'd you say, polenta?
Polenta.
On polenta. I think we have to take a break now. I'm speaking with Alexandra Harney, author of The China Price, published by Penguin. And we have to take a quick break. I'll be right back. I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate, speaking with Alexandra Harney, the author of The China Price, The True Cost of Chinese Competitive Advantage, from the Penguin Press. Alexandra, thanks for being here. Now, we were talking a little bit about the workers in the factories, just a little bit, but talk a little bit more about what's the physical cost to these workers? Do they have access to health care? I mean, or anything that American workers come to either take advantage of or are desperately pushing to get?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because about 1/5 of the workers in Guangdong province in the south of China that I interviewed had insurance, only 1/5. The rest of them, for various reasons, don't. One of the workers that I interviewed was a guy who was a star student in the countryside. When his mom got sick, he ended up having to come down and work in a factory hundreds of miles away from his family. And 2 weeks into his job, he put his hand in a machine and lost his arm. And so he ended up in the hospital. And it's funny, some of these hospitals have become real sort of centers where people can talk about what to do if you lose an arm, because he didn't have insurance, he didn't have any coverage, and so he ended up studying the law, becoming a lawyer, and suing his former employer for compensation. That's the exception. It's often, while there are more and more lawsuits in China, it's quite difficult to get good mm-hmm. compensation out of your employer. So I guess in America, we would have, you know, insurance, and you'd have all the precautions on the line, you know, lots of safety and health procedures that we follow in our factories. In China, they have the laws, but oftentimes the workers and the factory managers just don't follow them. Part of the reason is because all the workers that I know work on a piece rate. So you're not incentivized
per item.
Right, exactly. Uh-huh. You only earn as much as you produce. So if you aren't going to meet your quota for that day, then you won't be able to take home what you want for that month. Mm-hmm. And so there's no real incentive for you to wear the safety equipment that's perhaps going to slow you down.
So insurance, because I think for maybe a lot of listeners, particularly me, yeah. I want to know, what does insurance in China look like compared to insurance here?
It's actually quite good if you're covered by everything. There are five components to the insurance that a factory would buy for its workers, and that includes a pension. It includes, you know, medical. Technically, you're entitled to maternity benefits and leave. But part of the problem is that these pension benefits, for example, are not necessarily portable across provincial boundaries. So if you're a worker working hundreds of miles away in basically a different state in China, you're not guaranteed to be able to bring home your pension and sort of cash in and get it back when you get home.
Wow.
So you're sort of paying and you're contributing. You're making those contributions. So you're contributing into something you'll never get back.
And so you have to stay if you ever want to see that.
Right.
See that pension.
Exactly. And a lot of these workers don't trust that they'll ever see that money reasonably, and so they don't pay in. It's partly the workers don't want to be insured because they don't want to have to pay for that whole package of benefits because they have to make part of the contribution. So a lot of these things in China are more complex than just what we'd think they'd be. You know, the workers, mm-hmm. You know, all want insurance, but the government or the factories won't cover them. In fact, it's even more complicated. Some of the workers don't want to be covered.
And when you're talking insurance, are we talking insurance companies like Aetna or Prudential or the Chinese equivalent? Or
it's mostly public insurance. It's state-funded insurance.
Well, is it communist
yes.
country, so
in
I guess
name,
that
in
name. So you just mentioned the story about the 17-year-old who lost his arm in the factory, and that's a pretty compelling story. Were there any other stories like that grabbed you?
Well, there were a lot. One of them was a guy, the jewelry worker that I mentioned earlier. He'd been working in jewelry factories for about a decade. And I recount this story in the book about how when he used to go for a jog every morning, you know, just like an ordinary American, go for a run in the morning. And one morning he came home after his morning jog, and he'd had a really terrible sort of trouble breathing. And that was sort of the first sign of the trouble. And he ended up getting diagnosed with silicosis, which is really an epidemic in some of these factories. You get silicosis from inhaling too much dust,
mm-hmm.
and in these jewelry,
a particular kind of dust.
No, in his case, it was dust from polishing gemstones.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And it's not the case in every jewelry factory, but in the factories where he had worked, it seemed that he had, you know, just there were no safety precautions taken. The factory, of course, says that there were adequate safety precautions, but he believes that there were none or insufficient. Procedures. So he inhaled too much, ended up getting sicker and sicker, and 5 years later, after he won some compensation, he died, and he was 36.
Wow. What is that common for these factory workers to die at an early age? I mean, 36 is that's still a kid.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a lot of the real adventure and excitement happens at a very young age. These factory workers are going in their teens. No, it's not that common for factory workers that I know of. There isn't really good data on whether people are passing away at young ages. But clearly, if you've got an occupational disease and there's not an adequate system to take care of you, then you're gonna die prematurely.
So then what motivates these workers to go leave their homes in these far-flung provinces and go into these factories that, you know, Five Star Factory or the Shadow Factory, right, where their life and health is at risk.
Yeah. Money, first and foremost, but increasingly also the dream of an exciting life in the cities. So when China first opened its doors, basically, to foreign investment and started, that's back in 1978, and then started allowing more people to come into the cities from the countryside, the first generation of workers came in just wanting to, basically desperately hungry, just wanting to earn a living. And they worked, they basically work under any conditions. But the generation of workers now in Chinese factories are in their 20s. They were born after 1980, and they have a different set of desires. They want to earn money, yes, but they also want better conditions. And so, and they want a career, not just a job. So you see these workers increasingly changing the situation on Chinese factory floors by standing up for themselves, taking their employers to court, demanding better wages. And to me, these workers who have this more sort of a Generation Y workers who have a different mindset are going to change Chinese factories and the way they operate.
And where did the post-1980 Chinese, where did they get, I guess, the moxie to do that, to stand up for themselves and demand rights and benefits and better working conditions?
Really surprisingly, partially from the Chinese government, because the Chinese government has urged people to use the law as their weapon, and try to go through official channels to, try to get sort of their grievances heard. So partly from the Chinese government, partly they grew up in smaller families because in 1979, China introduced the one-child policy. So they were more doted upon as children. They came from perhaps a family of only three children because in the countryside you could have more than one child. And so they grew up in a different atmosphere. And then when they got to the factories, they were more aware of their rights.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Here for Leonard Lopate, I'm speaking with Alexandra Harney, the author of The China Price, The True Cost of Chinese Competitive Advantage, and this is WNYC and WNYC.org. So, Alexandra, how much control does the Chinese government have over individual factories?
The central government sets policies, and the local government is in charge of enforcing these policies. So the central government has very, very little reach directly into an individual factory unless there's really a big concern. I don't think they necessarily have any reach into an individual factory. The local government is charged with overseeing local businesses. And so the local government is also in charge of attracting investment. So you have local officials who are, on the one hand, trying to get more, more dollars coming in the door, and on the other hand, are also responsible for cracking down on labor violations and environmental violations. And so what we've seen over the last two decades or three decades is that basically economic growth has come first.
Mm-hmm.
And increasingly now there's a realization that that has come at a high cost. At a heavy cost to China.
Is there a major disconnect between national officials and those local officials?
Sure.
And how does that play itself out?
Well, it plays itself out in lots of ways. One way we see in the factories is that the central government will say, okay, this is our policy, and you guys go out and enforce it. And then the local officials will say, okay, we'll get to it. And there is, of course, some corruption. So we've got people, factory managers, trying to bribe the local officials. And, one guy I spoke to said, I asked him, how do you make sure that you don't get in trouble with the law? And he said, well, I just buy a Rolex for the right official.
So corruption is a major part of the China price.
It definitely plays a role. It's really difficult to say.
You should see her face because it tells me that it plays more than just a role. It's a major component.
It's really difficult to quantify. Clearly, there's not adequate law enforcement in China.
Mm-hmm.
How is that able to happen? One of the reasons is corruption. I visited a coal-producing region, China's leading coal-producing region, and I spent some time with an illegal coal miner. So China has a whole, like it has a whole network of shadow factories, has a whole network of illegal mines, secret mines. So if you had gone into the hills, you never would have known where this mine was. And I went up there, and it turns out I asked the guy, how do you survive as an illegal mine? And he said, well, you just pay off the right officials.
That is frightening because China is building, they're bringing online, a coal plant
a week.
A week.
Yep.
And so the idea that there are secret coal mines is really scary.
Yeah, and the Chinese government is certainly aware of that. But again, it's linked to this corruption issue.
Right.
If you're trying to crack down, I mean, recently, well, it was a couple of years back, they asked all the local government officials to turn in the money, the stakes. They said, okay, you have to sell your stakes in the coal mines. You have to relinquish financial ties to these private coal mines. Not all of them are illegal, but really government officials shouldn't be investing in coal mines.
Yeah. You know, we read, at least I read lots of stories about China and coal mining and coal plants and the air quality.
Yep.
When you go to these coal mining towns,
yep.
is it as bad or is it worse than what we're being told here?
It's bad. I stepped off the airplane in one of these coal towns and I could taste it. I could feel it in the back of my throat. I could feel it in my nose. You instinctively don't even want to breathe in very deeply because you feel like this acrid, gray stench is not something you want in your body. And at the end of the day in that area, your ears, your eyes, everywhere is filled with this little black dust. And that's what you can see.
Hmm.
So if you're living in that kind of area, and we've seen evidence that some of this stuff is coming outside of China to the rest of Asia and then eventually to the U.S., This is a global issue.
So what role then should the West play in improving laws, not only to safeguard the environment, but also safeguard these workers?
Well, I think everyone as consumers and even as investors can start to be more aware about what's happening, what's the implications of our pursuit of ever lower prices. Because part of the issue, I believe, is that companies themselves are going out to China, Western companies are going out to China and asking for lower prices, which then force Chinese factories to cut corners. And one of those corners that they're cutting is clearly labor rights. Another one is environmental compliance. So to me, consumers can start to look to the companies and ask, okay, do you have a report on the conditions in your suppliers? If you have a report, how honest are you being? Are you giving performance indicators and saying, this is what we want to achieve, this is the progress we've made in cleaning up these labor and environmental problems in our suppliers?
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. Investors can do the same. They can start asking more questions of the companies they're investing in. And I think that would be a really positive force because we as consumers care a lot more about the environment these days.
Mm-hmm.
We recycle. We can do the same for social issues.
We're running out of time, but I have three questions.
Okay.
Real fast. There's one from a caller who wants to know, has the U.S. government put pressure on the Chinese government to keep wages low and conditions poor?
No, the U.S. government actually funds programs to help educate Chinese workers about their rights, which is interesting. There's funding from the State Department, I believe, that goes through private organizations. And also the U.S. government has official programs with the Chinese government. So the U.S. government has no official influence on wages in China, but they certainly do make an impact in small ways on workers' level of awareness about their rights.
And the flow of migrant workers seems to be slowing. So how will that trend impact the China price?
Well, the flow of migrant workers is definitely raising wages. We're already starting to see those rising wages for some factories overseas, not just the rising wages, but the appreciation of China's currency. So we'll see rising wages and therefore rising costs of Chinese goods.
And last but not least, how do you think the upcoming Olympics will affect China's growth and development?
What will happen after the Olympics is really key to see how China is able to handle things politically, because when we see the images from China of the beautiful stadiums, we're all going to see one particular superficial China. But in the countryside, there are 800 million, 900 million peasants, farmers. So what happens to them and what happens to a lot of these migrant workers in the cities will be really key. And so I think it'll definitely be positive for China in the short term, but the political element will be key.
Leading up to the Olympics, I mean, we've seen the torch being protested in most countries where it goes. Do you think various countries will boycott either the Olympics or the opening ceremonies to get a message to China?
Yeah, there does seem to be a lot of talk about that. I hope not, because I think that we need to engage with China on these issues, and we're sort of in a critical period here. China itself sort of is facing a massive crisis in terms of its international image. So both China and the West needs to find a way to communicate better about the issues that are happening within China, in Tibet, and human rights.
Does the Chinese government actually care what the West and the United States in particular thinks of it?
For sure. For sure. I mean, China's increasingly integrated with the global economy, with, you know, international sort of institutions. And so what happens in China no longer stays in China. And China cares deeply about being, you know, perceived unfairly or spoken about in a way that it feels is unfair overseas.
And so would they view the West's and the United States' sort of aversion to what's happening with, you know, the monks in Tibet?
Yeah.
Do they think we meaning the United States and Americans are being hysterical, or?
Well, there is a real sentiment among Chinese people that the West doesn't understand what's happening in Tibet. Ordinary Chinese people think this is ridiculous. The Tibetans get subsidies and they live a better life than they used to. And why all the fuss? You know, the riots, the protests in Tibet were attacks on Han Chinese, the majority ethnic group. And so it's just a completely different perception. I'm just amazed at how different people see it in China versus the West. We see it as a clear-cut human rights issue, mm-hmm. and they see it as a domestic, an issue, a domestic uprising that needs to be put down.
Alexandra Harney, thanks so much for being here. Alexandra Harney is the author of The China Price, The True Cost of Chinese Competitive Advantage. It's from the Penguin Press.